Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Craig Cohen will be back tomorrow. For today, lawn and garden care is our topic, and to talk about it, we welcome back Sandy Mason, horticulture educator from the University of Illinois Extension. Sandy has been a regular guest on Focus since 1993, was it?
Yes, hard to believe, huh?
It's been a while, answering your questions on everything from the grass in your lawn to the vegetables in your garden to the potted plant in the kitchen window. But she hasn't been on the show since June. We were on a couple of months hiatus after David Inge retired, and that means we've missed having her all summer, a long, dry summer, which I'm sure makes things difficult for anyone trying to keep their lawn or outdoor plants healthy. We welcome you to the conversation with your questions on lawn and garden care for Sandy. To join us on the air, call 333-9455 or call toll-free 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Will's Facebook page, or you could tweet us. Our handle is Will Public Media. Sandy, good morning.
Good morning.
And, I actually brought a little show and tell, if there was a lull in the questioning, and I have been well informed that this is just about the most miserable looking potted plant, perhaps because it's spent the last 2.5 years in a decorative jelly jar, which I guess is never a good idea.
Yeah, it really is one of those things. It brings up a good point about the problems when we have containers, especially that don't have any way for the water to drain out. So it's just makes it so easy to overwater them, or people are worried about overwatering, so they don't water them. So, you know, you almost have to have a container with drain hole. So that's my suggestion to you.
The first thing is transplant the plant.
Yes, you need a new container that has some drain holes in it. That would be number one.
Can you even tell me what this is?
It's an impatiens.
This is an impatiens?
Yeah, absolutely. And they will live indoors. I actually have one that I had last year, kept it indoors for the wintertime. And it was, you know, kind of, it was a little sad, but it continued to flower, did fine. And then I put it out in the springtime, and it was great. So they can be kept indoors as indoor plants, but they need plenty of light indoors. But then they also need those good containers. So there you go.
Okay, can these plants, do these plants need a lot of light?
Because typically impatiens would be a shade plant in the outdoors. But when they're indoors, it may seem funny, but you actually need to make sure there's still plenty of light for them indoors. So it's not one you can just stick in a little corner somewhere and not have any light. So if you can put them on the, you know, east window, west window, south window, that would be good, where they get at least a little bit of, not necessarily direct light, but certainly some bright indirect light would be good.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to a caller now on line four. This is Peter from Milford. Line four, Peter from Milford, good morning. You're on Focus.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I don't like the way that film that you put down to prevent the weeds. I don't think it works that well. I still get weeds growing right through it sometimes. And I was wondering, I'm making new beds, and I'm going to reduce some old beds. And I was thinking of using some of that, like, outdoor lawn carpet or turf or stuff, you know, that you can put out, people scrub their feet on. And if I put that down, is that going to cause any, like, fungal infections or any problems underneath on the soil?
Okay, so see if I understand that. So these are for flower beds?
Flower beds and around some of my bushes.
Okay. And so you're thinking about putting down, like, AstroTurf?
Yeah, kind of like, yeah. You know, I know it comes in green, and I've seen it in brown, and I think Menards and Lowe's has that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I know it allows the rain to go through, and I'm hoping it prevents more of the weeds from going through. And I'm tired of the bark blowing away, so I'm looking for a uniform color in between all the plants and stuff, and I didn't know if that would work.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And would it cause problems in the soil, you know? I don't know if any fungal things.
Right. I guess my first thought would, I wouldn't think it would let water and stuff through. I mean, if it's the same stuff I'm thinking of, it's just like a plastic film for the most part, and then it has this kind of grass-looking stuff on it. And maybe you're thinking of a different product.
I'm sorry. I thought I saw some stuff that was, it looked like kind of porous, and it was just kind of woven.
Well, there are weed barriers that are more of a porous, you know, it looks more like a fabric kind of thing. Maybe that's kind
right.
of what you're thinking of.
I've tried those in my garden, and I still have those. I still have weeds growing right through it. Maybe they were underneath the film, and, you know, they're poking right through it. And I don't like the effects of some of that.
Right.
Unless you can recommend a super-duper product that works so much better than the stuff that you can get at, you know, like Walmart and all those other types of things.
Yeah, I think the one thing with weed barriers, I think they work best under like rock mulch, which I'm not a big fan of rock mulch, but people do like that, and they work better under that. If you use them under wood chips, what happens is as the wood chips decompose, weeds will just grow on top of the barrier, and you'll certainly get that, and then you end up with a bigger mess because you're trying to pull a weed out and it's stuck to the weed barrier. So it doesn't work very good, I don't think, underneath wood mulch. So I think as far as just trying to, you just have some general weeds and you're just concerned about them coming through, and that's really what the issue is for the most part?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. And what you may want to find is for some of the, I don't know what kind of wood chips you're using, but the bigger pieces tend to be the ones that blow and will float away and all that kind of thing. So if you can get some of the smaller ones, or actually if you can go to Landscape Recycling Center and get some of their smaller type wood chip, it tends to bind together better and it doesn't float away and blow away. So for a plant's perspective, they would much rather have wood chip mulch or something that's organic like that, to be honest with you, rather than using any of these kind of weed barriers and things like that. So you just have to think about, you know, does it allow water and air penetration, which whatever product you're thinking about using, you just need to make sure that happens. But from what I've seen, most of those, you know, I think what you're talking about would be good for a path, you know, if you want to do a path and something like that.
Right.
But actually in growing areas, not sure the plants are going to like it all that much.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you for your help.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, weeds are really one of those things. They're really tough. But just to always keep in mind that, you know, for a lot of those weeds, they need an open soil surface in order for the weed seeds to germinate. So if we can put mulch or something on top, that really helps to keep down those weeds.
Well, let's go ahead to our next caller. And we're talking to Tim from Champaign on line one. Go ahead. You're on Focus.
Thank you. This question goes in a whole different direction. It concerns the effect of chlorine, as in chlorine drained from swimming pool water, the effect of that chlorine on tree roots.
You know,
because I've heard a not necessarily very authoritative responses, but I've heard responses saying, well, you know, it's not desirable. Others saying, you know, it's not going to really have a great deal of effect, and so it's a matter of concern because it has to do with where we plant, and there are some arborvitae right at the moment. They have been there probably for 15 or more years that are dying. These arborvitae are not in the immediate area, but certainly their roots are going to spread out, you know, to the point where they are affected by the overflow drain.
Right. You know, this is one of those things that I've heard in a number of things, and I actually looked at a number of things. And I think there's a little debate back and forth, because a lot of it depends on what kind of products people are using actually in their pool.
Yeah.
And so that makes a big difference. I guess what I always think, I think about a couple things. Whenever you're, you know, dumping pool water like that, you're thinking of this massive inflow of water. How well does that drain? So I never want to be concerned about the plants that are in that area. Will they tolerate this sort of flooding effect? If it drains away fairly fast, maybe it's not a big deal. But if it's a high clay content soil, kind of a lower area anyway, some plants are not going to tolerate that. Arborvitaes don't really like that. Ewes don't really like that. So there's a number of plants that would not tolerate that very well.
Right.
Something like
a
sumac, they'd probably be fine with it. They'd probably love it.
The
other thing, as far as the chlorine, I guess what I always look at is if it's so much of chlorine that it's actually killing the grass, I'd be worried about the tree roots. If it's not killing the grass, because they're actually getting the chlorine's right on top of them, if it's not killing the grass, then I would say more than likely it's not going to be a problem for the tree roots in that area. So,
I'd
kind of look at those, see if the grass is still living after that, but then really, really think long and hard about, you know, how much of that water inflow and how often that happens. Those would be the things. I'd be more worried about that kind of flooding effect.
Right. A dry well, I suppose, is one way to go. On the other hand, the water the water is still there. All right? I mean, it's in the earth to be absorbed, and I don't know whether it would be an advantage to have a dry well.
When you say dry well, I guess I'm not sure I understand what you're...
Well, you know, digging a substantial pit that can then be lined with drainage tile or, you know, layers of rock and so on, simply as a way handling absorption.
Right, right. And that certainly would direct the water to one spot.
Yeah.
And maybe that would make more sense, especially so much of it, I think, would depend on the topography of the area and how well it's going to dissipate and how much clay is in the soil, those kind of things that would make the soil stay wetter longer. And it might even, you know, I don't know whether you can put that in a cistern. I don't know. That would be worth sort of looking into if there's other ways to even actually use that water. But so I think it probably takes somebody that really, you know, maybe knows a little bit more about the sort of drainage issues in your area and then kind of figure it out from there.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. This is Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows filling in for Craig Cohen today. My guest is Sandy Mason, horticulture educator from the University of Illinois Extension. She covers Champaign, Ford, Iroquois, and Vermilion counties, and she's answering your questions today on lawn and garden care. To join us on the air, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we have another caller now on, let's see. It's line 3, Laura in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus with Sandy Mason.
Hi, this is Flora. I have two questions about my hydrangea and my hibiscus.
Mm-hmm.
The hydrangea bloomed, it was white. So the blossoms have always been white. This year they're like a light green.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it's because I was throwing my coffee grounds out into that garden. That's the only thing I know that would have turned them any color. What do you think?
Well, I assume this is one that's supposed to be white. It's probably like an Annabelle or one of those. And usually green is just an indication of sometimes a lot of them actually will go from white to green. That's their normal phase.
Okay.
So it's just a maturity. It's the maturity of the flower petals themselves that often will turn green. I don't know. I've heard a little bit about some people think that maybe if they're in more shade, they tend to be more green. I'm not sure I've ever heard that, but it probably didn't have anything to do with the coffee grounds. That's really a matter of, you know, some of the hydrangeas, if there's more aluminum in the soil, it does change the color from pink to blue kind of thing. But it's really a phase of aluminum. It's not so much what might be in the coffee grounds.
All right. Thank you. And the other question, my hibiscus bloomed late. When it blooms, the flower doesn't open, and it just hangs down until it falls off.
Okay. This is the shrub-type hibiscus, or this is a the big flower, or?
Oh, yeah, it's in a pot. I guess you'd call it a shrub.
It's a tropical. Hibiscus is really confusing because there's a shrub that's a hibiscus, there's a perennial flower that's a hibiscus, and there's a tropical flower that's a hibiscus. So it's very confusing. So is this one of the tropical ones, maybe?
It might be just the perennial one. I really couldn't tell you.
Okay. Well, it could be, and it could be any number of things. If it sounds like somewhere along the line the bud's actually getting damaged, or could they have dried out too much? That certainly could cause it. Being in a pot, sometimes they dry out too much. It'll go ahead and they won't even open. If we have a lot of humidity and moisture, sometimes flower buds are actually very sensitive to some of the fungal diseases. And we've certainly had weather that, if this is just happening recently, we've certainly had weather that might happen. But usually it's one of those things that sort of subsides over time. And, you know, but I'd really watch how much you're watering it. If it's in a container, of course, they take a lot more water. So that might be one issue. So I think I'd probably watch that. But I have a feeling it's one of those things that's probably going to subside over time.
Well, I'll just watch for it. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, caller. This is Focus on WYLL. Jim Meadows here with Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension, answering your questions on lawn and garden care at 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. And Richard from Robinson, I hope I have those names in the right order, is on line four, waiting patiently. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thank you, Sandra. I have a suggestion for your first caller who wanted to put down weed impermeable something.
Mm-hmm.
I faced the same problem, but I had lots of old shag carpet that I had pulled up from rooms in my house, and I cut it into pieces. It fortunately was a tawny green, so it fit in with the landscape, and it does a great job. It allows the water, the rain and my hose water, to go right on through. And you can slit it and fit it around shrubs and trees and bushes, whatever you want to protect. So I suggest the man do some shopping at Tips, those big containers that people put out when they want to get rid of junk.
Yeah, yeah, and if you get it green, it's great. That certainly would work, because a lot of that even has like a jute backing, and some of those actually decompose fairly well too. So it's certainly an option, sure. I can't imagine any weed getting through it.
Sandy, I have one more comment. I dread the fact that you are to be on only periodically at somebody else's impulse or suggestion. I pleaded with WILL to put you back on a regular schedule so that people could stay at home every morning or every hour when you're going to be there. And I got unsatisfactory answers telling me that I could look it up in Focus. When I first joined WILL years ago, I told them not to send me Focus because it had so many things that could not apply to me, like television and FM and going off the air at nominal sunset. So it was a waste of time to receive Focus, so I told WILL to save the postage. I plead with other people in similar situations to send letters to WILL and get you back on a schedule, which should be, I would think, better for you, knowing that you had to reserve a Thursday or a Friday or whatever out of your schedule, which must be busy. Thank you for letting me rant and rave.
Well, thank you for your support. I appreciate that. I know that there's had to make some changes here, but I certainly do appreciate your support.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
And thank you. And I guess one regular place that they can find you, at least a lot of the time, is on Mid-American Gardener,
mm-hmm.
which is on live every Thursday night at 7 on WILL-TV, and that is a live show where mm-hmm. You and all the other panelists are taking questions from callers about whatever they have to ask about gardening and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And we even do show and tells, like your lovely plant here.
Yes.
People can actually see your lovely plants.
It's an impatience. It's in a bright green decorated jelly jar, and I will report back on how Sandy's advice works. Yeah.
It's about a foot long with only two leaves, maybe four leaves at the top.
It's been desperately grasping for the sun. At any rate, let's go on to our next caller. And Lawrence in Savoy on line one, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Now, I know glyphosates are very effective killers on grasses and other green plants. My question is, what herbicide is really good on vines and trees?
So you have a number of trees and stuff that are coming up and having problems with them coming back?
Yeah.
Like mulberry.
Squirrels and the birds and the wind has planted trees
right.
that I don't want.
Right. Right. And actually, glyphosate can be effective as a cut surface treatment on some things. But I have found mulberry is my sort of the one that I end up having to kill off on a regular basis because the birds, of course, bring in the berries and, you know, do their thing. For that, actually, glyphosate doesn't seem to be quite as effective. So if people have mulberries in particular, what I've found to be more effective is some of the brush be gone type killers. It's triclopyr is the herbicide that's in that. And so the brush be gone as a cut surface treatment. So in other words, you cut it and then you just immediately paint on or spray on the product. And you don't have to drench it. You just put a little bit on. And it has been actually quite effective on mulberry. So I've had much better luck with that.
I didn't understand what you meant by... Did you say you cut it first?
Yes, you cut it. It's called cut surface treatment. And if you read the label, most of these will tell you that that's one way you can use these products. And the nice thing is that because you're using a cut surface treatment, you just go in and you either cut it with loppers or saw or whatever, and then immediately, you don't want it to dry, you don't want the surface to dry, immediately you go ahead and either paint on or spray on, and you just need to wet that surface
cut. You're talking about sort of incising the bark and making slices in the bark. You're not talking about cutting off the plant.
No, I am talking about cutting off the plant.
Oh.
You just cut it. You just cut it off with loppers. And it works really well on, especially if you have young little seedlings of, you know, if it's something that just seems to be too big to dig up, like a mulberry or something that's kind of come up. And you don't want to spray the foliage on those because they're often, you know, intertwined with whatever trees or shrubs that they're coming up in.
So you're talking about pouring it in the ground, then, not on the tree.
You don't pour it. All you do is just take your loppers and just cut it, just like you're cutting it off. Now, if you were just to cut that off and not use a herbicide, what you'll find is they resprout. So what you do is you just cut it off completely. And then that surface, that little bit of surface, you spray on or paint on the herbicide on that little spot. And often it only takes a couple drops. It doesn't take much of anything. You don't have to drench it at all.
This must be tremendously effective. And what's the name of the
chemical? It's very effective. Usually you're going to find it under brand names like Brush Be Gone, but it's triclopyr.
Triclopyr.
Pyr, yeah. T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R, I think is
How long has that been known and around?
It's been around. Brush Be Gone certainly has been a product, and that particular herbicide has been around for a number of years. But it's very effective, and the nice thing is you're not spraying chemicals all over the place. You're just doing this very lightly. Again, it doesn't take much at all. You don't drench it at all.
Now, if one is not worried about getting it other places, is it quicker and more effective if you spray it on the leaves?
I find this cut surface treatment to be very effective, personally. And it's actually because it's taking it up. You know, the plants actually, you're really cutting into their, for lack of a better word, veins, arteries, whatever you want to call it. And actually, then the herbicide is right in there. So it's very effective.
And what diameter trunk would you say this method would still be working on?
I've seen it used on very large things, like even a foot in diameter. I've seen it used on very large things. It depends on the chemical. Sometimes you have to go with a different chemical on the larger trees. But
sounds like a very beneficial herbicide. Well, thank you very much.
Right. Bye. Right. And then typically on the bigger stuff, sometimes you'd actually just cut the outside surface. You wouldn't cut the whole tree. But
the time is... almost 10:30. It's time for a short break now. This is Focus on WYLL.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeffrey Toobin about how the Supreme Court decisions on Citizens United and the Affordable Care Act will affect legislation for years to come. His new book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Toobin's also the author of the bestseller The Nine. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Craig Cohen on Focus on WYLL. We're talking about lawn and garden care with Sandy Mason, horticulture educator from the University of Illinois Extension. And we're welcoming your questions as well this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WYLL or 800-222-WILL. Let's say good morning now to Jerry in Urbana. Thanks for waiting patiently. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I'm calling about the man that called about the AstroTurf, using it to get rid of weeds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why it had not occurred to me to try that. And I think it would work. Originally, the very first AstroWeed they used, I can't remember the stadium, but I remember laughing when I read about it because it had killed, not laughing at the deaths of billions of earthworms, but it killed billions of earthworms.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a stench, they had to replace it with the new AstroTurf. But I'm thinking that if any fungus or anything grew under that, with all these football players hitting it, now some of them have to have allergies. People in the stands have to have allergies, so that would be spreading all over the place.
Hmm.
Well, I think that would work. I'm going to try it, and I'll call back next year and let you know if it worked, and let him know if it worked.
Yeah, it's interesting, and then to see what happens underneath. That's always the thing, like you were saying, underneath.
Yeah, I'm sure it wouldn't be growing any fungus because, you know, I have allergies, and it just doesn't take a whole lot of mold to get me in bad shape. And I'm thinking out of all those football players, I know some of them have allergies.
Right.
Plus people up in the stands.
Right. Well, it's certainly interesting to think about trying that. But I think I always go back to, you know, how, you know, it's one thing to use it in areas where plants aren't, where you're not trying to grow plants. So I always think about what's underneath, because the roots, obviously, the plants are going to end up going underneath there. And is that really going to be a good place for them to grow? Is there plenty of air in the soil? Is there plenty of moisture? All those kind of things. So I kind of think about the plants themselves growing. So it's a little bit different than using it on a football field, but certainly would be one of those things that people wanted to try it. Might be an option.
I've just got a small area that I try to grow flowers in, but I grow a whole lot of weeds. And it's really hard to grow flowers there.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if we shouldn't switch to weeds, huh?
Well, I try to think back at one time, modern-day flowers used to be weeds.
Yeah, and I tell you, this year with the drought, I was just amazed at how well the weeds grow. In the middle of this drought where there's no water, the weeds grew very well and really made me think twice about what we're growing. So,
you drink water,
interesting.
Goes a long way
for absolutely. That's why they're weeds, I guess. Well, good luck.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you, caller.
Bye-bye.
You're making me think of Ray Bradbury's novel, Dandelion Wine, which goes on at great length on all the things you can use dandelions for. Not just wine, although apparently it's quite a good one. And must be easy to round up a dandelion crop without trying.
Yeah, I was actually at a place a couple of weeks ago, and they were actually growing dandelions in their hoop houses, in their greenhouses, and were selling them as greens. So there you go. There's some options there.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to, let's see. I'm trying to reach Brian from Champaign. Good morning. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Well, you're on Focus. Go ahead.
Yeah. I grew some potatoes this year, and I was pulling some out yesterday. But I took a trip to Prince Edward Island earlier this month, and I bought a bunch of potatoes from there. And anyway, I was wondering, does it hurt if I leave the ones that I grew here in the ground until I use the other ones up?
Yeah, the only thing is, I think you'd probably be better not to leave them in the ground, because they do have, if there's any entry at all, they have a tendency to go ahead and rot. If they're not like perfect, so I would be a little bit concerned. So I think I'd probably go ahead and dig them. But you certainly, if there's any way you could put them in like a cool, you know, kind of moist place, you know, someplace where you could sort of keep them. But I think in the long run, you know, if the plants have died down, and I assume they have, the plants have died down. Yeah, once the plants die down, you're really better off to go ahead and harvest them.
Okay. So, well, I put them in the refrigerator one year, and they developed a sweet, off-putting taste.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, a little bit too cold for them.
Yeah,
for that.
Okay.
Yeah, a little bit too cold.
All right, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. And, well, potatoes sound like a vegetable that you can store for some time. It's not like it's celery or something.
Right, absolutely. And I think probably a couple, and I should have mentioned, too, is that once you harvest them, if you can let them in a warmer, drier place, let them sort of heal over those areas maybe that are still a little soft, and then store them. So you kind of do a little bit of a processing thing. But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, way back when everybody had cold storage and great places to store a lot of things. And we just, in our homes, everything tends to be warmer, and we just don't have those kind of cold storage areas like people typically would have. But
Well, we're talking lawn and garden care on Focus this morning with Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension. Welcoming your call at 333-9455, 333-WILL, and you can call toll-free at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. One thing I was wondering, you know, since you've been here at last, we've had a lot of not very much rain. It's been a very dry summer, and people's lawns and gardens have had to survive all that. You have to make some preparations for the fall anyway, with the drought in mind. Does that change the sort of things that you should be doing?
Yeah, I think it is one of those. One of the things that I've noticed in particular was I was really surprised how well lawns have recovered. And, you know, I didn't water my lawn at all. And I have a few spots that didn't make it. But I have a lot more green grass than I thought I was going to have. So I think that just kind of shows you that, you know, plants are amazingly durable if they're halfway healthy already. So I think probably one thing to think about with lawns is if you do have those open areas, if it's just a few inches, you know, maybe even up to 6 to 8 inches, I think probably the big thing to do now would be maybe to go ahead and fertilize. This is a good time to think about fertilizing lawns, and that will help the grass that's there sort of fill in those spots. So if you don't have really big areas, you may want to think about, and you might even, you know, take a rake and maybe, you know, kind of get rid of some of that dead stuff that's in there. If you have really large areas, you might think about reseeding. This is a good time to reseed those areas. But if you, again, if they're 6 to 8 inches wide, you know, spots, I would just fertilize what you have and really try to get that grass growing that's in there. So try to fill in those spots there, or use some seed for larger areas. And just always keep in mind that when it comes to weeds, weeds are always going to be attracted to those open areas. So anytime you have an open area where there's nothing growing there, that's where the weeds are going to come in. So you need to get the grass growing or get some seed in there, something, so you don't have those open areas, and that'll help for weed issues in the future.
We have three callers waiting right now on Focus. Let me say hello to Brian in Champaign on line one. Mary Ellen in Gilman. I have to keep up on my notes here. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you. You were just speaking about potatoes. I wondered the best way to harden sweet potatoes so they will last through the winter.
Yeah, sweet potatoes are a little bit harder. Actually, they generally don't keep as long as our regular Irish type potatoes. Mm-hmm. And once you dig them, if you can put them in a place where it's warm, it's kind of the same idea as the other potatoes, where it's warm. And usually what I do is I just go ahead and let them maybe even sit out in the garden and let them dry up a little bit, because you want that outside to kind of dry up and harden.
Right.
And then to go ahead and store them in a dark place, in a semi-cool, you know, if you had a place that was in the 60s, that would be wonderful, or would be a better place. So if you can get them in a dark, cooler spot, that's good. But I usually leave that at least for a day where they go ahead and harden that outside skin. That'll help. And to be honest with you, I generally, when I dig my sweet potatoes, I don't clean them right away. I let them dry. And then once that soil kind of dries a little bit, you can kind of take it off. Or a lot of times I just store them with the soil on them, and people may not find that attractive. But they tend to last longer, I think, because you're not doing a lot of, they have very thin skin, and the more you're scrubbing them or trying to clean them or whatever, you're breaking that skin. So I just leave them, and then I clean them, and obviously before then I cook with them or use them. So any way you can kind of do that, I think it works out better.
Okay, I appreciate your help.
Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
And thank you. Mm-hmm. Some sweet potato advice here on Focus, where we're talking with Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension. Let me go to Savoy and Patricia in Savoy. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. My question is in regards to my vegetable garden. I came from Indiana, where I had sandy loam, and now we have clay. And I'm trying to break down this clay and help keep the moisture in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you had any suggestions for this fall.
I would say compost, 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 and then a little bit more compost. Actually, organic matter is a great way to break down clay. And actually, really what we're trying to do, not so much. The problem with clay is it has very, very tiny particles, and they tend to hang on to each other.
Right.
So when they get dry, they stay dry. When they get wet, they stay wet. So what you're trying to do is help that clay to sort of aggregate and sort of be in bigger clumps. And compost is great for that. So any kind of organic matter, or if you have, or if you have even, you know, if you've got some shredded leaves you want to add for the winter time, you know, anything like that is going to really help the clay. And then the more you get that organic matter in there, then often you'll get more worms, and then the worms do a really good job of sort of helping to break up that clay as well. So I think that's really your best bet, is to really go with compost.
Excuse me, but what if I don't have compost? I mean, it's a new housing development.
Right.
And you know how they strip the black dirt.
Right, away. I know. So do you have, and I'm sorry, you're in Savoy?
Yes.
Well, you can certainly get it from the Landscape Recycling Center. And most people have these kind of places nearby if you check with your public works or wherever. But in Urbana, there's a Landscape Recycling Center, and they do have compost available.
Okay.
And you can either get it in the bucket load, or you can get a truckload delivered, however you want to do it. Yeah, it's great. And it's great stuff. They really have some nice stuff. We use it out at our Master Garden Idea Garden quite a bit. And it's really good stuff. We like it a lot.
And they deliver?
They do. They absolutely do. So Landscape Recycling Center, they're out on East University. If you go to the city of Urbana's website, I'm sure you can find the phone number, or it's probably, I'm sure it's in the phone book under just Landscape Recycling Center.
Oh, well, I really appreciate
it. Sure. It's great stuff.
And then do we rototill it in?
Yeah, you can either rototill it in, but this time of year, actually a lot of times I've just put it on the top surface, and what you'll find is the worms and stuff kind of work it in. So it kind of depends on whether you want to go ahead and rototill it. If you feel like you want to do that, it certainly gets it into the lower layers better. But you can kind of just depend on how you want to do that, but you don't necessarily have to.
Well, I was just thinking of rodents and...
Yeah, compost is so much like soil. You typically aren't going to find a lot of rodents and stuff sort of hanging out in the compost.
Okay.
So,
well, thank you.
Okay, good luck.
Bye.
Sure.
Thank you. Let's go now to, let's go to Earl Park, Indiana. Mike in Earl Park, good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, good morning. I was wondering on apple trees. I've got several that need the radical trimming. When's the best time to trim them back?
To trim apple trees?
Yes.
Yeah, probably typically we would do that. You know, you certainly could do that now to some extent. We probably usually do that more like in February and March when we know they're dormant. So to do some severe pruning. And I will tell you, with apple trees, they're always kind of funny. If you do severe pruning, you tend to increase a lot more growth. They kind of respond with more growth. So you may find that you really, if you need to do a lot of pruning, you may want to stretch it out into 2 or 3 years if you're really having to do severe pruning.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you. Let's go now to, let's go to Belgium for our next caller on Focus. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning, Ms. Mason. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
It's been a while since we spoke.
I know.
Yes. Throughout the show, you've been talking about some different things. You've mentioned hibiscus. Now, hibiscus can even be a tree in South Pacific. They use it for lumber. And you also mentioned impatiens. Do you know impatiens grow wild in Taiwan?
Yeah.
Underneath the jungle canopy. They get very little light there, but they seem to grow just fine.
Yeah.
And the last thing I wanted to bring up, and maybe we can talk a bit more about this. Before Western Europeans showed up in North America, there were no earthworms, what we call earthworms. They were imported by people bringing soil here as ballast into the Chesapeake area and dumping the dirt out and then loading up with tobacco or whatever else they wanted to go back to Europe with. And the earthworm spread, or the earthworm that most of us think of, spread all over the United States. And I mean literally all over the United States and Canada. They've done a very good job. And you were talking about earthworms doing a real good job of keeping the soil aerated and stuff. What do you suppose did that before the earthworm showed up?
I don't know. Good question.
sure there was some sort of natural system that worked good.
Right, right, right. And you know, it's not that earthworms were never here. They were just wiped out through the ice age. So they certainly were. I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, there's certainly a lot of animals and stuff that, you know, bigger things than earthworms that move the soil. You know, moles and voles, and there's lots of activity in the soil. We know that. But yeah, that's actually a good question on how different the soils would be. That would be a good question for a soil scientist, I'm sure. But yeah, interesting, huh? Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize earthworms are actually not native to North America. At least these earthworms aren't.
Yeah, the worms we use.
Yeah, what we call earthworms, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, interesting.
Thank you. And let's go ahead to our next caller, Dave in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus with Sandy Mason.
Yes. What can we do about excessive mowing along roadsides early in the season when the prairie plants are showing their best, and or at least they're showing? And I think it's a job issue, but is there any way that the university and other authorities can help to reduce that mowing and the cost of gas and equipment and biodiversity, pollination, and whatnot?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, actually, I see a lot less mowing than there used to be, and certainly the university has sites now that they, you know, that they don't mow, or they only mow periodically. So, I mean, I think I'm seeing, you know, maybe it's not quite as fast as we might like, as far as how fast people sort of quit mowing or not mowing quite as much. I think there's certainly been a change in that from what I've seen, and I live out in the country, and I certainly know the farmers don't mow nearly as much as they did when I was a kid. So I think we're seeing it, and maybe it's just a matter of, you know, the gas prices and stuff. People just don't want to spend the money on it, so for whatever reason. But, you know, I think it's just more and more people just really have to think of why they're mowing and how they're mowing, and is this an area that really needs to be mowed? Because there are certain areas that need to be mowed periodically. Otherwise, you will get a lot of woody species coming in, and I know some of the park districts have to kind of, you know, work through that, but maybe not mowing as often. That's probably a big thing for everybody.
I sometimes see in front of a farmhouse, like 6 acres of.
Yeah, I know. I know. I wonder about that too sometimes, but that's a lot of mowing. But I know sometimes people actually like to mow. But I think everybody, and I see that more and more now. I hear about that more and more now. People ask the questions on how they can, you know, develop part of their landscape, part of their property into prairie or into something where they don't have to mow. So I think there's a lot more interest in that. So it's happening. I think the more you talk about it, and the more we sort of think about what we do with our landscapes and stuff,
that's,
I think the better off
going,
it is.
So.
Yeah, I know. You bring it up. That's always good for people to start thinking about it. So
okay,
that's
thank
good.
You.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dave. And we're running into about the last 7 or 8 minutes of Focus here on WYLL with Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension, horticulture educator there. And we're talking about lawn and gardening issues and welcoming your calls, especially at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WYLL or toll-free at 800-222-WILL. Craig Cohen will be back tomorrow for a program on Focus with independent congressional candidate John Hartman. He's running for the U.S. House seat of the new 13th Congressional District against David Gill and Rodney Davis. But for the next few minutes, it's lawn and garden care with Sandy Mason. And, you know, one thing I was wondering, we were talking about soil types, mm-hmm. and in the counties that you cover, is it all the same soil type around here? Do people run into a lot of different soil types?
Well, there are actually a lot of different soil types, maybe not so much as in other areas of Illinois, but there are a lot of soil types. And I think, you know, certainly what we find is that just what the caller earlier talked about, that sometimes maybe there was particularly good soil there, good black soil, what we think of as good black soil, but then through, you know, development or building, that soil gets removed. And so people end up with those lower layers of soil, which usually has a lot of clay in it. And so they're sort of dealing with this issue, even though we're typically in an excellent area for a lot of great soil. So, yeah, actually, in some areas, we actually even have some sandier areas when we start getting into Iroquois County and some of those other counties that are a little farther north. So it's always interesting.
Okay. Well, we have some callers lined up here. on line one. Beth from Champaign is calling in. Good morning, Beth. You're on Focus. And maybe I didn't press that button quite right.
Okay.
Beth from Champaign, there. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if there is any type of jasmine plant that can survive in this climate.
Hmm.
Not necessarily, you know, a big tree. But what I would like ideally is a jasmine plant I can have indoors.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know of any of them that survive outdoors. But certainly if you're going to bring it indoors anyway, there's certainly a couple of different jasmines that do actually quite well as indoor plants. If you have plenty of light, they tend to be high light plants. But I don't know of any of them that will survive our winters, if that's what you're thinking.
Yeah.
I don't know any of those.
Is one particular type better for indoors than, say, stronger than another type? Or can I just go ask for a jasmine plant for indoors?
Yeah, I think probably what the thing I would ask is, you know, some of them tend to vine and some of them tend to be more like a little shrubby thing. And so I think if you're really wanting for indoors, I'd probably, you know, I don't know if you really want something that's going to vine a lot. Because that'd be more of a space issue. So I think that'd probably be the question I would ask is that, you know, what's kind of the habit?
Shrubby.
Does it vine or, you know, what kind of a thing does it grow that way? And I will tell you, there's certainly a lot of plants that we can grow outdoors that are quite fragrant if you're looking for that. Some of the viburnums and some of those are quite fragrant. So we do have some that will do well.
Yeah, I would like more with fragrance outside. Outdoors.
Yeah, there's some
viburnum, you say?
Oh, yeah, there's Korean spice viburnum and Birkwood viburnum. Those are really very fragrant.
Very
nice. And just great shrubs, too. So.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Sure.
And thank you. Let's go ahead now to line three. And line three, Bobby from Champaign, you're on Focus with Sandy Mason.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. I am having some squash issues. First of all, I've had an infestation of what look like stink bugs, only a little bigger, but when I've crushed them, they don't stink, but they ooze green. They're gray and kind of trapezoid-shaped, and they seem to be incomplete metamorphosis because I've seen the nymphs hatch directly out of the very neat little rows of very straight rows of red-brown pinhead-size eggs, small pinheads. And then I've had yellow and black, yellow with either black dots or black stripes, totally eating up the male blossoms. My friend told me they go for the pollen. And then I just heard from someone else that the reason the my stems are dying as there is yet a third insect. And they thought it was a corn rootworm grub that kills the stems, sucks juice out of the stems. So there's insects. Then the squash I planted were mystery squash from a friend's worm bin. So I didn't know exactly. Yeah, but they really flourished until those bugs got at them. I mean, my whole back fence was just covered. And, hey, you know, that's a great seed starter. And so I have these orange squash. They're obviously winter squash. They look kind of like a flattened pie pumpkin, only they don't have the grooves like the pumpkins do. They're a little bit bumpy, and they're dark. They're a dark orange, and then they're maybe 6 or 7 inches across and 3 inches high, and they're dark green at the stem and the blossom ends. And do you have any idea what those would be?
Well,
kind of squash.
Well, the problem is when you save seed like that is that you don't know. These guys cross-pollinate readily, so, you know, it's hard to say. It could be pumpkin, zucchini mix. I mean, who knows what it is? I mean, it just depends on what they had near, you know, when they were growing these, whatever ended up in the worm bin, wherever they were growing those, what was nearby. So it's, you know, there is no way to really tell you exactly what it is, but it certainly can be a cross because they cross like crazy.
Yeah, I've had acorn squash that I harvested myself out of my garden and planted the seed myself and planted them in the ground, and they became pie pumpkins.
Well, again, they cross like crazy. You know, they're cross-pollinated.
Yeah.
So you never really know.
Pie pumpkins close by, so.
Yeah.
Pie pumpkins were what we got.
Yeah. So you just, yeah. So I can't really tell you exactly what it is. It would depend on that. But it sounds like you have squash bugs and cucumber beetles, and you can get squash vine borers. There's lots of things that unfortunately can attack squash.
And what do I do about next year? Do I have to plant in a different area, or is there something I can put on? I try to garden organically. Is there something I can put on the area? There's hardly any foliage left at this point. There's one acorn squash and six of those strange squash, and hardly any foliage left at all. So is there a way I can treat the area, or do I just plant them in my front yard instead of my backyard or next year?
Yeah, probably the biggest thing for a lot of these insects that attack squash and all these guys is to get rid of that foliage. A lot of this stuff overwinters on the old foliage or on the old stems or in the old stems. You have to get that stuff out of there, and either it needs to be actively composted or buried or something, because a lot of times, so just good sanitation, getting all that stuff out of there can be very helpful. The cucumber beetles, or actually the root worms, is really once the corn starts dying down and they start harvesting, we always end up this influx of, depending on what crop it's on, either cucumber beetles or root worms. So that's always going to be a big issue for you, unfortunately. Those will just come in later. But good sanitation.
So if I compost that vegetable matter, the leaves and stems.
Yes, actively compost it. Bury it.
In my tumbler?
That'll
work?
Yep.
And I'm sorry to break things off here. Thank you very much, caller. That is all the time we have on Focus today. Craig Cohen will be back tomorrow with a conversation with congressional candidate John Hartman.